and he's taught American, non-Western literature and world religions. He's been a Fulbright Hayes and NEH scholar on China and India, and he's lived and taught in Japan and on the Colorado River Indian Tribes Reservation in Arizona. A man of many parts, and I am pleased to have him with us today. Welcome, Frederick.
Hello, Miriam. It's a pleasure to be with you and your guests.
Thank you. I'm also delighted that Julie Clayton, our reviews editor, is with us today, and she will be co-hosting with me and actually interviewing Frederick. So I know that Julie really enjoyed his book, and that's why she wrote such a fantastic review. And that's why I invited her to take over the interview with Frederick. Welcome, Julie.
Hi, welcome. I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for letting me be part of this. Hi, Frederick. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Julie. Nice to speak with you again and all the listeners.
So Miriam is quite right. I was so impressed with Parliament of Poets, your book. And I have to admit, I was at first a bit hesitant to read an epic poem, which is what this book is. It's not something one comes across every day.
No, it can be an intimidating idea to people today. It sounds so deathly dull and whatever. You think of Homer thousands of years ago or something. But really, maybe a better way of thinking about it is it's like a story around a campfire, as one person at a epic poetry reading I gave responded. And in that way, I'm really trying to create a story, sort of like what the shamans would tell in the ancient caves or whatever.
And that really does come across. So perhaps you could say a little bit about what an epic poem is, for those who are not familiar with that term, and a little bit about the book. That would be great.
All right. My pleasure. Now, you know, there's a very long tradition of epic poetry, not just in Western tradition, sort of a Greek-Roman civilization, but East and West as well, in India, in China, there are epic forms, and many other civilizations, African and so forth. So I decided as sort of in my mid-20s, I was back in 1982 or earlier, that I wanted to write an epic poem, try to write an epic poem that would be a global, universal vision. All the past epics, for logical reasons, were all regional, local, that is focused on, of course, Greece, Rome, Africa or India, wherever. So I wanted to try to write the first global epic poem, perhaps, that would embrace the entire planet and draw from the religions and the literatures of all civilizations. And I truly have spent more than 30 years studying and trying to figure out how to do that in a way that would also honor the literary traditions of East and West as well. So I draw, for instance, from the Indian Ramayana, one of the great epic poems, from the Bhagavad Gita, from Dante, the Italian poet, and John Milton, the English poet, and so forth. And I try to work within those forms, if you will, but dealing with the problems and concerns that are contemporary to us today. How can an epic poem speak to life today is what I'm trying to do. And one of the keys in that to me was Joseph Campbell's essay in 1979 titled Earthrise, after the Apollo 11 landing sometime. He basically remarked on how the overview image, if you will, of planet Mother Earth from the moon has changed our consciousness. And that's the basic image with which I'm working.
You know, I think a demonstration would really help our listeners. Why don't you give us an example, a section of your poem?
Okay, my pleasure. From the second chapter, epic poems are often different chapters referred to as books. So this is the beginning of book two And I'm drawing somewhat from my experience on Indian reservations and reading Indian legends and myth and so forth. And this is the beginning of book two, On the Moon. A great war cry went up. Drums, tom-tom, the deep bass sound, tightly stretched hide. Chanting of many braves, pounding of hearts, clearing a space. Poets made room for a young Lakota Indian brave, strong and virile, raising a hoop before him, dancing the hoop of his people, the hoop of all the peoples of Mother Earth. Far above, while all stood round, the poets and seers, shamans and singers, griots and troubadours, bards and rhapsodes, watching him pounding moon dust, mesmerized, for he danced in another world, the world, as it were, of the moon. Behind him, all could see the hoop of the earth, beyond the hoop of the hoop of the moon, within the hoop of the moon's own hoop, the hoop of our rotating solar system, the hoop of the spiraling Milky Way, the hoops of the innumerable galaxies, the hoop of the endless universe. His long braids spun with the planets, spinning on their axes as he weaved in and out through the nine hoops, and the pounding of the drums pulsed through the arteries of the universe.
Lovely. And thank you. So thank you for that. Tell us, Frederick, a little bit then about the where this takes place. Takes place at the poet on the moon, yes?
At the Apollo landing site, the Sea of Tranquility, Apollo, the Greek god of poetry, calls all poets, ancient and modern, east and west, to assemble on the moon for a parliament of poets to debate the meaning of modernity. And they select one poet they referred to as the persona, Greek for mask, whom they send on a journey, a sort of Jungian journey, if you will, to the seven continents, visiting all the major religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, Christianity, so forth, around the world, and different civilizations, Machu Picchu, Chartres Cathedral in Europe, Africa, visits Ibo land in present-day Nigeria and so forth, and all over Asia, Japan, China, and India.
I love the vision of Apollo calling all poets and wise people to the moon to debate the meaning of modernity. I mean, it's such a contemporary question, and it's so deliciously wrapped in history and culture. And the poet, the persona character, he travels many journeys to find the answers to the meaning of modernity. Does he find an answer, and where does he go to look for these answers?
Well, I'm so delighted that you like that, and I do hope he does find an answer in a way. Of course, a paraphrase or prose statement with poetry, I'm always drawn in two directions because the whole nature of poetry is to suggest and intimate nuance and so forth. And I fear that if I say the poem means this or that, I've limited it in some ways, because as a reader, you may have a sense of how broad the scope I'm really trying to deal with. All of human history and culture, religious thought and reflection is what I'm really trying to grope with. And where can we as a race, humanity, human beings, go from here with all our problematic baggage, if you will, history and otherwise, and violence and so forth. So anyway, through all that struggle, he goes back and forth to the moon four times. The Apollo and the Parliament of Poets send him back and forth into the caves of Lascaux, In Blombos Cave, very famous new cave, just discovered in the last few decades in South Africa, that goes back to 70,000 years before the Common Era, and they've just found remarkable artifacts there by left by early Homo sapiens and so forth. And so, in a way, this journey back and forth, it takes on many symbolic dimensions for me in my mind, and I don't want to cut them all. I worked 30 years to put them there, so I don't want to nail it down and say this is it. And sometimes there's a tendency in poetry or literature or whatever, we get the meaning and now we've got the plum in the pudding kind of thing. We take out the plum and we got it, and really it's about the whole pie. And I think in some ways, through all the books, different journeys, I'm trying to create a universal vision of life on this planet, suggested. And there's a quotation in a letter, passage in a letter by Beethoven, in which he's talking about how all the clashes of his music and the conflicts are all about resolving those things in terms of the form of music. And that was one of the key passages in struggling with how do I write an epic poem for our time or attempt to global. And I just felt that in a similar way, I'm trying to create this orchestral music, if you will, symphony, in which the resolution is felt in ways more than thought, and we're such an age of cerebral for the last 150 years plus and whatever modernity, and we've lost touch with the heart and the feeling and the spiritual so much, and so the real language of my poetry, to me even, is not the English language. It's the myths and the metaphors and the symbols that I use and try to create and develop, and the way they play off one another to suggest this resolving music, if you will, from the moon, this vision of Mother Earth floating in the dark blackness of space.
Yes, well, as you know, in my review, I actually used the symbolism of an orchestra. So for this reader, this enjoyer of this art form, that certainly is how it impressed me. And I mean that in the sentient sense, not the cerebral sense. And I really appreciate what you're saying about this being poetry. To me, my words, it's an art form, and we really can't dictate what that means to people. It is an experience, lovely experience, and perhaps this would be a good time for you to read another brief passage so listeners could have another sense of that for themselves.
All right, I'd be delighted. This is an excerpt from Book 6, set in Japan, with the Japanese poet Basho, haiku poet whom I'm sure many listeners are familiar with, and mention is made of Saigyo. Saigyo precedes Basho by about 500 years and was one of the very famous Japanese poets as well. Set in Japan, Basho took a long time to reply. Not far from here are the ruins of the ancient capital of Omi. Like the cherry blossoms of my own hermitage, like those that Tadanori sleeps under in the night, the petals his eternal host, all things pass. Nothing is permanent in this floating world, yours or mine. A breeze in the branches sway, their petals flutter to the floor, like snow covering the ground, wayfarers treading upon them. Lowering his voice and eyes with a glance. We nodded in heartfelt agreement. He continued, I will bring all the poets. All will meet you on the moon. Join in, attend the parliament of poets. Our sensei Saigyo will return you to his great metaphor, the moon. Turning, Basho faced the edge of the woods, from which a figure emerged, an old man in a humble monk's robe, master and students, bowing respectfully to one another. Basho faded as a shade upon the wind, while I, a shade in the making, remain, lingering on with another spirit master who waited for me to join him at a distance. In moonlight, now shimmering on Lake Biwa, evening fading into night.
Lovely, thank you, thank you. Frederick, can you talk a little bit about what the new global universal vision of life is?
Well, for so long, the world was given to isolated regional civilizations in China, the West, Africa. Every place was isolated for millennia, really. And every civilization thought of itself as the center of the universe. As the centuries went by, we were all shocked to discover there were other inhabitants around the world, and all the problems of history developed, some would argue. But we now just take it for granted. For so long, we've been evolving into and moving into a much greater degree of contact to where, with modern travel, communication, the internet, everything, we've really become a global civilization, and we're on the threshold of that, all the more many perceptive and sensitive people have thought for a long time. And so what I'm struggling to do is to embody that vision, and that vision doesn't originate with me or the poet ever in whatever epic poem it's often said. The epic poet is sensitive to what the vision is for the time and is trying to serve it, not in and of itself create it. And so I do think of it that way, that this vision is greater than I am, and it's something that I'm trying to help other people see through an imaginative journey, if you will, back and forth from the moon and looking repeatedly across the vast distance of space to Mother Earth.
So the vision essentially is one of sort of a global vision that you're trying to express, that we are no longer that isolated individual communities and cultures so much as we are a global, you don't use the word family, but, you know, a single species, humankind, sharing the same resources and the same hopes and the same dreams and the same challenges.
Well, yes, I think so. I mean, I don't believe we're all going to become mush, as the expression is, you know. But on the other hand, I do believe there's that unity, that human unity. And as Saul Bellow, Jewish novelist, wrote in the early 60s even, we're all being mixed and poured together. Well, then we've gone so far beyond that time even, where we're all living together. In the United States and elsewhere, the city I grew up here in, Michigan, was a very isolated, white-only community when I was growing up. And now it's absolutely international. Everybody on Earth lives here and works here, and it's... You know, that's happening not just in the United States, but in many places all over the world. And yes, there are holdouts, shall we say, but in the long run, that we human beings, we know genetically, anthropologically, and evolution, and everything else, that we are one ultimately. And so our life has changed, but our consciousness hasn't quite caught up yet. And in struggling with how to write an epic poem and what, I'm very much trying to serve that vision of human unity and oneness that so much of the new consciousness movement has come to realize long ago.
He said the magic word, new consciousness.
That's right.
Actually, I was curious, having worked on a poem for 30 years, how do you feel now?
Well, just an absolute relief to have finished it. I had sort of this Satori moment, if you will, where I was, and by the time I got to draft five of it, it just hit me like the proverbial ton of bricks. Oh my God, I've done it. It's sitting on my desk. You know, it's not in my head anymore. I'm not struggling with it. I've got five drafts out. I'm not going to put it through many more beyond that. And eventually, before I felt it really was done. But for so many years, really, it was a matter of notes, reading. I'm going to add this in. I want to do that. How am I going to bring these together and synthesize them or whatever, and harmonize them? So it's sort of like must be the rush of Jungian individuation. You know, you just feel this intense sense of satisfaction. So now the problem I have is helping other people know it exists, because I really, part of this has been that it has to be, I have to publish it over a decade and a half. I felt it has to be in a post-Gutenberg way and global. It's a global epic poem. I hope people will recognize it as, and I have to find a global, universal way to reach the readers, and through the internet and through the other new communication channels, such as your own and others. I feel this part of my duty here, obligation. I want to set that example that it can be done, that the poet in Africa, in Bangladesh, both of where my book has been read and reviewed, anywhere on earth can know, because it's been not done in act, not theory, that if you write something worthwhile of humanity, you can publish it and reach the whole globe.
Well, I actually had a higher vision than that, Frederick. You know how on space probes they have these little goodie bags full of things like Vitruvius Man, and it is my feeling that they should include a copy of Parliament of Poets, because you give this overview, this panorama of the best of human civilization, the voice of her poets, the voice of her dreamers and thinkers. And you've done it with great honor to each of them. So I do want to commend your book to our listeners. Don't be intimidated by an epic poem. It's really, and coming back to that image of the storyteller sitting around the campfires of the world and dipping into and weaving the story of humanity in the most beautiful, mellifluous language. So kudos to you, sir. 30 years were not wasted. Here, here.
Well, thank you so much, Miriam. It's an honor for you to say so and think it. I'd be delighted for such a thing to happen. But
if anybody listening has contacts with NASA.
Wonderful.
Okay.
So,
Frederick, how do people learn about what you're doing now? Do you have a website?
I have a website at fglacier.com. My last name spelled unusually. I'll spell it out. fglayshear.com. Or just go to either Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, or Google Play and type in the Parliament of Poets, and you'll find my epic poem out there and take your own journey to the moon.
Actually, you will find it on NC Review as well, complete with a purchase link. In fact, all of the books that we discuss and all of the interviews will be on our website, ncreview.com. I just had to add a word from our sponsor, obviously.
Well, Marla. That's great. Happy.
And do you have another work in the pipeline?
Well, actually, I have a book of essays that are going to come out in September titled The Myth of the Enlightenment, in which I'm really trying to struggle with the more nihilistic vision of modernity, Nietzsche, God is dead, and so forth. And these are really essays that I wrote sort of during working on my epic poem that were landmarks for me in grappling with all of these things myself. Tolstoy and Tagore, the Indian poet, Rabindranath Tagore, I have a couple of essays on each of them in there, and they're very important to my own development as a writer and poet. And that will be available too in September. Very readable, and I hope some readers, listeners, will seek me out there more too after reading my epic.
You don't take life easy, do you?
Well, what's it for? You know, we have to keep working to justify our existence.
Frederick, thank you so much for joining us today. It has truly been my honor and privilege both to speak with you and perhaps even more so to read your amazing, wonderful book. So thank you so much. We so appreciate it.
Thank you, Julie. I really appreciate your talking with me and sharing my vision with your listeners. You too, Miriam.
Thank you, Frederick. Frederick Glacier, author of The Parliament of Poets. And we also spoke earlier with Patty Conklin on her book, God Within. Well, that's kind of our show for today. I do hope that you will join us next week. Until then, I'm Miriam Knight.